joining us. They got a new podcast that you can stream, download, subscribe to. We're talking about the technical intricacies of podcasting here before the show opened tonight. Haughty by Nature. Love the name, by the way.
Not because we hate you.
We don't hate you, Walter.
We do not. We love you.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I really do. Who came up with that name?
Oh.
Was it a group effort?
It was a group effort.
It was, yeah.
About 100 text messages back and forth.
We spent some time on it, yeah.
Some really bad ones that we don't need to repeat.
That'll be for a future podcast.
Right, y'all, the outtakes of potential podcast names. Closing argument, my name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream this program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights, live and local. Appreciate you tuning in. If you miss us for some unconceivable reason, you can just do a search in your iHeartRadio app for Closing Argument, and our past shows will pop right up. We got a channel there in the app that you can go to, 651-989-5855, if you want to join our little brouhaha tonight as we discuss a variety of topics. But we're going to start off with the topic du jour that has been dominating attention in the media and on social media throughout the week, and that is, of course, the ongoing controversy involving NFL players taking the knee in order to protest a variety of, it seems like a continually expanding circle of things that are being protested. It started off as something very specific, which was police brutality, and which is also, you know, obviously attached to the broader criminal justice system itself. But it seems as though now, you know, we had an article from Huffington Post that we talked about last night where the headline was something to the effect of white NFL players who stood beside their kneeling black teammates were standing for white supremacy. So now apparently we're at the point where in order to not be a white supremacist, you have to kneel during the national anthem. It's odd how the goalposts, figuratively,
nice,
keep getting moved further and further in terms of what it is we're actually talking about. You guys have this new podcast, which I must confess I haven't had the opportunity to take a look at yet. I'm looking forward to it because I know both you guys. I know you guys are deep thinkers, libertarian thinkers, and your perspective is much needed in the discourse here in Minnesota, and hopefully you'll get a national audience with the podcast as well. That's the beauty of the internet and streaming. What's your take, and I know it's different than the one that I've been delivering here tonight, on what's taking place and just the reactions that people are having and where we stand with the NFL?
So, Walter, I saw your Facebook Live thing, I think it was Monday night, on this topic, and it was interesting. It irked me because you said they shouldn't protest. Not because you disagree with their ultimate goals or the topic they're talking about, you know, criminal justice reform and police brutality, things that we all, I think, here share a lot of, you know, agreement with. It was they shouldn't protest because it's disrespectful and it's like a kid talking back to their parent. And that really bugged me because for a variety of reasons, but how can you subjectively say people should or should not protest peacefully, mind you, peacefully without inconveniencing anyone else? I even disagree with you on, you know, blocking highways for protests.
Right.
The same thing.
Right.
We've talked about that.
Yep.
But even this peaceful, very short, doesn't inconvenience anybody. You said they shouldn't do that. I guess my question is, when should you protest if you do have any modicum of an argument against some systemic wrong? What better place than to use your public profile for the 2 minutes that you're on the field that very few people are watching you on TV until they put it on Fox News because you kneeled? What better place to just represent what you believe in than that? I mean, that is almost the easiest possible place. I can't say that, but a very easy place to protest compared to occupying Wall Street, blocking highways, doing other things that are arguably more violent.
That's Carl Eggers, by the way, of Haughty by Nature podcast. We've also got Brendan Peterson in studio with us. I'll start with where you left off, which is the evoking the opportunity that players have given the spotlight, the platform that they've been offered. It's quite the presumption to assume that that's your spotlight and your platform to do with whatever you please. It doesn't exist. People aren't tuned into NFL games to hear your political opinion or to entertain your protests. And so you're imposing upon, and I guess it depends upon how the owner of the team feels or how the NFL right. feels, sure. yep. which is something that seems to be a moving target, but you're imposing upon them, you're commandeering the purpose of the various sponsors and partners in the NFL franchise, and imposing upon the fans something that they did not tune in for. So, you know, which goes to your first question, which is how do you say when you should or shouldn't engage in protest? And I think part of in order to answer that question, you first have to identify what is the purpose of a protest. And I'm ready to entertain the fact that the purpose may be different for different people. Mm-hmm. To my mind, the only rational purpose for a protest is to actually affect change, to change people's minds and thereby create an environment wherein you can pursue changes in policy. And so in that context, you don't get to decide just through your intent whether or not your protest is effective or appropriate. You actually have to get the feedback. You have to listen to what people are saying in response to what you're doing. And the responsibility falls upon you to craft a method and a message that actually accomplishes what you're trying to accomplish. And so when I say you shouldn't protest in this manner in order to affect the change that they claim to be seeking, which I'm sure is genuine, I don't question their intention. When I say that they shouldn't, I'm saying that it's not affecting the purpose that they claim to be pursuing. And it also to your point about the appropriateness of being disrespectful or what have you, that as a matter of social decorum, which again is something that we all get to have a say on, right? Like there's nothing. It's interesting to me, the kind of circular argument here, where on the one hand it's how dare you say that somebody can or cannot protest, but then immediately following that, it's how dare you, being me,
right,
say what you think about that protest. It's like, if they can say what they want, then I can say what I want.
Right.
That's what a discourse is.
I agree with that, right.
And so I'm judging, which they're putting this out there to be judged, and so I'm judging it as inappropriate based upon my perception, which is shared by a great many people, that it is disrespectful to our culture, to our nation, to our flag, and what it represents.
Brandon, you have a different view, slightly.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, obviously. So the first question is, you know, what is your individual take on the matter? I mean, my personal preference or what I would do in that exact situation is I would stand with my hand over my heart, and that's what I would do, because that's what I feel like is the right thing to do. And that's in line most with what I believe. Because of the fact that I view the anthem and the presentation of the flag as something that brings community together, you know, the nation in general. It's something that I have reverence for, you know, my neighbors and the folks that share this place with me, and also for the ideals, not necessarily the current government all the time, but the ideals to which we espouse or aspire to as a nation. However, I will take issue with a number of the things that you said, Walter. I mean, I think, I have absolutely no problem with people using the venue to protest. You pointed out the fact, especially, you know, and you mentioned circular arguments, and I'll bring up maybe a counter point or pointing out a circular argument on the other hand, which is, you know, people don't watch the NFL to hear your political opinion, or this is not a political venue. And I, you know, as somebody who voted against the Viking Stadium, and for the folks, many of whom, the majority of whom I believe in the city of Minneapolis, who didn't have a choice but to participate in the political process by way of their public financing of the stadium, you know, they didn't have a choice to participate in that process either. And so at its core, even the Pentagon itself contributes millions of dollars every year, the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, millions of dollars every year for quote-unquote patriotic displays, at NFL games. So they are inherently political. There are political messages being put forward, and the anthem itself is a political exercise. Now, whether or not that exercise is something that you deem to be good or worthy, or is a political exercise that is noble, isn't really my point. My point is that it absolutely is, and that goes back to the earliest traditions of, you know, a sport, really. I mean, when we think about the Olympics, you know, if you want to go back thousands of years, there's always been this intermingling of civilization, the nation state, and sport. You look at, you know, Jesse Owens, you look at Jackie Robinson, you look at Muhammad Ali, you look at these examples throughout history, and these are integral moments and pieces of our fabric as a country. And I think there's space, actually, and I think that's what's so unfortunate about Mike Tomlin's decision in Pittsburgh to go after Villanueva, the offensive lineman who decided that he wanted to stand outside and he wanted to respect the flag because for him as a veteran that meant something to him. I think there's room for both, and I think we can actually say, you know what, I respect you, you respect me, and let's have a civil discourse and let's engage each other in a way that's productive. I think, and just one more point about that, about coming together rather than being divided. Does anybody here, anybody listening, really believe that Donald Trump didn't know what he was doing when he said that? Of course he did. Yeah. And so if we're granting that he knew, right? Then what we're saying is we knew the president intentionally divided the country, right? And his advisors have said as much since then, saying this is unpopular. He even refers to ratings in his tweet.
Right.
So the president engaged in intentionally divisive activity, and he got exactly what he asked for. And I think what we could do, and I think what would be great, is if we all said, you know what, we're not taking the bait. We're cool. You can stand and I can sit and we can have this conversation. And I don't think there's a need for demonization in general.
We'll take your calls when we return. Lenny, hold on. We'll get to you when we come back. That's Brendan Peterson. We've also got Carl Eggers. The two of them are on a new podcast, Haughty by Nature. Fantastic name for a podcast. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Check out the
Well, if our conversation regarding NFL players kneeling during the national anthem demonstrates anything, particularly taking place as it does between yours truly and our in-studio guests tonight, Carl Eggers and Brendan Peterson, former state senator here in Minnesota, all of whom, all three of us, identify as libertarians, what it demonstrates is that the principles of liberty are easy to assent to, but not always easy to apply to real-world situations. And we have some various headlines that we're going to try to do that with here, and it'll be interesting to see if we have agreement or controversy. Closing argument, my name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app, two ways to stream the program. We're here 9 to 11 weeknights, 651-989-5855, if you want to get your word in edgewise. Brad Omlin taking those calls. From the Star Tribune, St. Louis Mayor Leda Cruson and Interim Police Chief Lawrence O'Toole on Wednesday called for the U.S. Attorney's Office to investigate allegations of police misconduct during protests that followed the acquittal of a white former police officer in the death of a black man. Cruson and O'Toole said in a statement that the St. Louis Police Department's Internal Affairs Division and the Civilian Oversight Board will investigate the police response to protests over the past nearly 2 weeks, during which more than 200 people have been arrested across the region and nearly three dozen officers injured. But they said a third-party investigation is necessary because it is important that the public have confidence in the results of this process. Email messages seeking comment from the U.S. Attorney's Office in St. Louis were not immediately returned. The statement said police internal affairs have received a dozen complaints. The American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri has also filed a lawsuit accusing police of unnecessarily forceful arrests and rounding up innocent bystanders on September 17th, when about 120 people were arrested following an unruly protest downtown. Now, again, trying to apply these libertarian ideas that we often banty about, what wins out here, police accountability or federalism? Like, is there any part of you that's a bit hesitant about the idea of bringing in the feds to investigate local policing matters? Either one of you?
I think hesitant's a good word, but in St. Louis, with their history, how can you say that increased scrutiny over police actions, especially actions of police departments that have shown to be militant or worse, is a bad thing? I get the federalism argument, but I would have to weigh in on the more we can uncover police action and inaction and root causes of that, the better. Going back to the criminal justice topic, I don't think, but the federalism, I don't even know it holds water here, because they're not superseding.
They're being invited.
They're being invited and say, we want your opinion on this topic, right? They're not saying you rule instead of our state or local.
But you're inviting the camel to stick its nose under the tent, so to speak. You're inviting a higher level of government to bring its subjective values and standards, which could very easily supersede your own. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with you. I'm just evoking the concern because I think it's an interesting concern. Honestly, I don't know which way wins out in my own consideration.
Well, I mean, absolutely. Every bit of the federal apparatus should be looked at with suspicion when getting involved in state matters. You know, of course, there's the issue, though, of constitutional liberties.
Right.
You know, if everybody is guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution certain things, and if a state does not have the right to abridge certain freedoms. And so if that's a case, certainly that warrants involvement. I've long been of the opinion, particularly when I became aware of some of the issues with internal prosecutions of civil liberties issues when it comes to state policing, that attorneys general offices across the country should all have an independent prosecutor that is solely focused on internal investigations type matters or policing matters, so that there's an independent in state. So that eliminates the need for federal intervention, someone whose job it is basically, because what we've also found is, of course, district attorneys who have to work with police departments in their own jurisdiction have a conflict of interest in holding them accountable, right? Because they rely on them to do their own job. And so, and they have that sort of incestual type relationship. And so, yes, I mean, the answer is yes, there should be absolutely some suspicion. And there's a lot of federal issues. I mean, we've talked a lot about, militarization of the police over the last few years, although that's coming, that's died down with the new administration and Sessions, who are kind of 180 degrees different than the previous administration in that regard. So there's a lot of issues there to talk about. But yeah, the short answer is yes, they should be suspicious, but we got to protect people's civil liberties too.
Going to the phones, let's talk to Joe in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program. You're on with Carl Eggers and Brendan Peterson.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. I wanted to refer, and I think this is one thing, I just never hear any real facts coming out. There was an empirical study conducted by Harvard professor Roland G. Fryer that just came out within the last year. He's the youngest tenured African-American professor in the history of Harvard. He did a study in thousands of hours. He wanted to help Black Lives Matter, but he wanted to give them statistical data. So he did this study, and he actually found out that blacks are not more likely to be shot at when use of lethal force. In fact, it was not even close. It's much more likely that a white person's going to get the police officer's going to use that force. In fact, 20% less likely. Now, this is an empirical study. He spent thousands of hours. He's a really smart guy, knows how to do a study, and I never hear anybody talking about it. There was another study out of Washington State, basically came up with the same kind of numbers. He said it was this professor at Harvard, he says, not even close. And he was trying to help Black Lives Matter and give them some firepower, statistical, actual, factual data.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out the opposite way. But, this is a guy that knows what he's doing. So when you talk about facts, forget Colin Kaepernick. He doesn't, he's just, hands up, don't shoot, never happened. Over 40 witnesses came forward, most of them black, who said that, that never happened. But still that narrative went through the media, and people are still, on the Internet and listening to that and seeing that today. But I would like to know about your guest addressing that study by that Harvard professor, Roland G. Fryer, Jr.
I appreciate your call, Joe. It's hard to address the details of a study that you haven't read, and I'm guessing neither one of you has flipped through the pages of the particular study. I haven't either. I suspect, or at least would not be surprised to learn that notion that white people are more likely to be shot by police than blacks isn't accounting for the difference in population. In other words, there are more white people. So,
yeah, and I haven't read. I saw the headline of that study. I haven't got into it either. And for me personally, it's less about this topic is less about race. Not that that's not about race whatsoever.
Sure, sure.
But for me, it's less about race and differences and proportions and less likely, more likely to do that, and more about two things. One, the war on drugs.
Right.
And how that adversely affects every aspect of our society, economically, racially, in terms of the prison system, use of prosecution, in civil asset forfeiture, things like that. One, the war on drugs is the biggest culprit, and two, the militarization of police. It's those two things that we should be looking at further rather than, well, it's if you're white, you're more likely to do X, or black, that's not as important or useful to me than really analyzing why do police use lethal force? What are they looking out for? What are the reasons that they are searching your car? Or why are they suspicious of you being a white, black, other person? It's probably because they think you're in possession of a substance, more likely than not, right? And that's a major problem with our criminal justice system, more so than racial inequality, which may exist.
Carl Eggers and Brandon Peterson in studio with us tonight from the Haughty by Nature podcast. Check it out on iTunes. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Rush Limbaugh.
Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. In studio with me tonight, Carl Eggers, Brandon Peterson, both of the podcast Haughty by Nature. Libertarian, I imagine, the content on your guys' podcast. Tell us a little bit about the podcast. What is it that you guys, what's it formatted like? What do you typically talk about? Is it just reaction to the news, or is it topical, or what's the deal?
It's all of the above. We started it in, we had some really great conversations, myself, Brandon, and Gary Miller. And we thought we just want to do it for fun. But Gary put it really well. It's an interesting conversation you hear walking by a group at a bar. Of like, well, those guys are really talking about some weird stuff, or
sure.
And we cover everything, politics, sure, from a libertarian view, but we did haircuts.
Let's run through the topics we discussed at the last and the first episode. So number one is it's a kind of a unique format. It's completely uncut. So everything we hit record and just go for 60 minutes. There's no editing. And so we discussed, sort of the nature, a little bit of my personal political experience, where I was. We talked about hairlines. We talked about the Anunnaki and Nibiru, the horned planet.
Which the apocalypse didn't happen.
The apocalypse.
Last week.
We talked about Bitcoin. We talked about
football.
Tacos,
football.
We talked about the NFC Central, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we cover everything. And it's a great time, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's different, especially, you hear a lot of things you wouldn't hear on a typical produced show because we don't cut anything.
And we're haughty. And the whole point is to be honest, and that's what podcasts can give us of
right.
Like, hey, let's just be up front and have fun and
right.
Talk like friends we would at a bar and not hold back within reason. And I think we've accomplished that in the first one, and we're excited about keep it going, and just we're entertained by it. And a lot of people have been so far as well, which is really cool to see. But we just want to have fun and be real, so to speak.
Yeah, that's the key, is do what you enjoy. And if other people like it, that's just a bonus.
Exactly.
Haughty by Nature, you can find it on iTunes. Let's go to the phones. Dan in East Bethel, thanks for holding and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to say, are you guys familiar with the reports
by the Department of Justice that was reported by PragerU that I believe factored in the percentage of each population and of like white, black, Asian, different things, and then talked about the likelihood of them to be shot by a police officer. I know it also said that a black officer was 3 times more likely to actually discharge his firearm in the line of duty than a white officer. And they went across the board in different areas. And so I'm just curious if you guys are familiar with that study at all.
I'm just familiar enough with that one aspect of it that you mentioned, Dan. I appreciate you calling, that being that black officers, and I believe it was specifically black officers, are more likely to discharge their weapon in encounters with black suspects than white officers are, and which kind of presents an interesting implication or questions as to what the motivations might be there, what sort of social dynamics might be in play. I don't know what I'm supposed to take away from that, though. Mm-hmm. To your guys' point that you were talking about earlier, is the real issue, should we really be so focused on the racial component here, or are there broader issues that are more important to take up our attention?
Well, right. I mean, I think for me, the biggest issue is, okay, do we have a healthy suspicion of the state that we do when it comes to fiscal policy as limited government advocates, when it comes to speech? We should look at the police power with the same level of suspicion and say, are we protecting people's constitutional rights just like we are protecting their pocketbook, just like we're protecting their ability to live their lives according to their own values, all those things that we typically stand for in all these other areas. The police power is an awesome power. We should also be suspicious of that and make sure it's doled out in a just manner.
Real quick, before we go to the top of the hour break, from the Star Tribune, police officers physically removed a woman from a Southwest Airlines plane before it took off from Baltimore. The latest passenger scuffle to be captured on video and magnified on social media. You know, I got to think these incidents were probably happening before cell phones became so prolific and we just didn't know and didn't care.
Especially in Baltimore, that stuff happens.
Yeah.
I've seen The Wire. Yeah. All the time.
After saying she was severely allergic to animals, this is the setup here. You couldn't write this. After saying she was severely allergic to animals, there were 2 dogs on board. The woman refused the crew's request to leave the plane. The crew then called the police to intervene. A film producer recorded the ensuing struggle between the woman and officers and posted it online. The scene from Tuesday night was reminiscent of an April incident in which security officers yanked a man out of his seat and dragged him off a United Air Express flight in Chicago. So more drama in the airways for you. More cops. Look, if you don't want the cops to drag people off planes, don't call them. That seems to be the object lesson here for the airlines. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We'll continue with Carl Eggers and Brandon Peterson when we return. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Thanks for listening to...
We had a primary runoff in Alabama last night, and it has been characterized as a major defeat for President Donald Trump. One of our in-studio guests has a different analysis for you tonight on Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. 9 to 11 weeknights, we are live and local. Appreciate you tuning in. 651-989-5855, the number to join us if you feel so inclined. Brad Omland taking those calls. Our guests in studio, Carl Eggers and Brandon Peterson of the podcast Haughty by Nature, which you can check out on iTunes for your libertarian-flavored commentary on pretty much everything, culture,
haircuts,
politics, mm-hmm. haircuts, hairlines, what have you. Good stuff from the sound of it. I'm definitely going to check it out. You should too. Brandon, you were speaking to during one of our breaks the popular interpretation of what took place here in Alabama versus what's really going on. Can you give us your hot take on that?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously the mainstream media's take has been this is some sort of repudiation of Trump. Because when why? Of course, because Trump endorsed Luther Strange, right? So therefore, you know, ergo, it was a repudiation of Trump's endorsement. Trump is waning in influence and he's got soul searching to do or something like that. However, aware understanding, if you're in tune with Breitbart News, the machinations of Steve Bannon and the like, and understand the popular economic nationalist movement in the United States right now, you'll understand exactly the opposite is true. Breitbart has targeted Alabama for months, has propped up Roy Moore and before that Mo Brooks before he dropped out, and has targeted Luther Strange as Bannon's sort of warning shot to D.C. to say those who don't support the economic nationalist agenda of the Trumpism versus Donald Trump, and I'm borrowing that from John Nolte, so I'll give credit where credit's due at Breitbart. It is an absolute endorsement of the Trump campaign. Now, whether or not Trump, as a influenced by the swamp creatures that he's surrounded by and surrounded himself with to a great extent, endorse Luther Strange as an exercise of expediency doesn't mean at all that movement is waning. In fact, they had a major victory in Alabama with Roy Moore, and absolutely will not affect Trump's influence. And Steve Bannon today is more influential than he's ever been, playing off of Trump's victory, now winning the first major intra-party battle in Alabama. And that's the hot take.
So I can't articulate a counter argument to that. I'm not even going to try. I do find myself fascinated and riddled with questions, though, as a result of this, because it seems that the emergent fact from that analysis is that there's a difference between allegiance to Trump and Trump himself as a carrier of the message and the message that he was carrying. And that, in fact, there is some coherent Trumpism, as you cite, that is articulatable and transferable to other candidates that they can run on, and a movement that's surrounding that is active and moving forward. What are some of the tenets of that movement? Because I'm not quite sure I could list them off at the top of my
head. Well, absolutely. If you go back to the Trump campaign, it's everything that he talked about. It's America first trade policy, what some people might call more protectionist policy.
Sure.
It's going to be anti-hard, hawkish, anti-immigration positions. It's going to be a strong sort of nationalist bent on foreign policy, and probably, in the case of Roy Moore, was probably more of a social conservative, but
right.
But certainly all of those populist messages that and definitely, if anything, anti-establishment, anti-DC, and particularly anti-Mitch McConnell. These are people who are running campaigns not against Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, but actually running campaigns against Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. And that is what won in Alabama. And that is what other candidates are going to do. You saw Senator Bob Corker in Tennessee that day announce that he's not running, who certainly would have been a target of this same Bannon coalition, if you will. And that's what you're going to see. And I think what it means for Donald Trump, if he can kind of have any degree of introspection, is that the movement is beyond Donald Trump right now in this country, and I think that Trump, Trump went to Alabama to campaign to rally for Luther Strange, and they went through, and half of that crowd said, "Yeah, we really appreciate that Trump is endorsing this guy, but you know, we support Roy Moore." You know,
so going back to last year's campaign, Donald Trump's campaign, Trump doesn't strike me as a guy who's particularly ideological and who latches onto ideas because he's thought deeply about them. Did he kind of just sort of trip into a movement that was basically being born onto the world at that time? Or is it that the ideas that he articulated became something above and beyond his campaign and his person, in your view?
Well, I mean, I think that My take is that a lifelong Democrat decided that the timing was right and had the right connections to the right people, Steve Bannon and those types, to reform himself, recreate himself in the public eye, who understood the hot button issues that he could run on in a Republican primary, and understood at this time of a great frustration, you know, coming off of, you know, a lot of frustration around the Bush administration and kind of a malaise during the Obama administration, where nothing seemed to really change a whole lot. And in a middle America that feels like, you know, the country's moving in a direction that they no longer recognize, and it was a perfect storm of things. And yes, so Bannon and others, other strategists filled in the blanks, sure, you know, of in Donald Trump, what Donald Trump cares about most, in my opinion, and I think what is you see in his comments over time, is that Donald Trump cares first and foremost about the advancement of Donald Trump.
Right.
And if you can convince and articulate a path forward to the presidency that includes whatever the things are that he ought to say, then he'll say them. And oftentimes there are 180 degrees in things that he said 10 years prior.
Yeah, that kind of tabula rasa interpretation of Trump's approach seems to bear out with an analysis of his pattern of behavior. And Bannon has said as much in terms of, you know, who he surrounds himself with. He's a reflection of who he surrounds himself with. So now he's got people, you know, chatting in his ear saying, hey, you should endorse this strange guy. Hey, you should go this direction on policy. Hey, you should sit down with the Democrats and cut deals. And so that's what he's doing because that's what he's hearing, which I don't know if I'm terrified by that, or I don't know how to feel about it. But
well, if you believe Roger Stone at all, which is probably healthy to not believe Roger Stone and what he believes in entirely, but it's a very cynical look at executive power, right? And of electoral power. You know, as a Nixonian, it's a very me first. I can do what I want. I can manipulate these people. I just have to push a sequence of buttons,
right?
Like you said, and I can get power. And I think that's exactly what happened here, right? Like, if I just hit this button, I get this response from this crowd. Wow, they loved it. They love build the wall. Maybe I should hit that button again. Oh, right. What do you know? Right. You know, I'm president. So I think it's a highly cynical thing where you surround yourself with the Bannons and with other people, and all of a sudden you get yourself up, and then that doesn't seem to be working anymore. You surround yourself with others, and you endorse Luther Strange. You stop draining the swamp. And
you reverse your position on DACA, which has been overwhelmingly negative in the media and then the establishment class, the well-heeled class. You know, at the rally, it sounded great, right? Mm-hmm. But now that he's in front of a different audience over time, they've all of a sudden you see these positions again, 180 degrees different than they were 6 months ago. And so, yeah, I mean, it's good because fortunately, like, for example, World War III is not popular. So if he's finger to the wind, hopefully he sticks to some of his more, you know, I hate to say it, isolationist.
Polling numbers on World War III? I haven't seen.
I haven't lately. To be honest, I haven't checked them out. Yeah.
Has there been a Harvard study that's
Breaker use?
Maybe we need a caller with a study on World War III. I don't know, but. So maybe there's some hope that the popular will can keep us from some of the some of the bad things. Yeah.
So are there implications for this? And this might be getting a little bit into kind of the more of the activist weeds, but are there implications for what we're observing here in terms of the difference between what's called access-based politics versus confrontational politics, where basically what we're seeing pan out here is if we've seen different wings within the Republican Party successfully engage in access politics, in other words, getting access to Trump and steering him in the direction they want him to go, and seeing a degree of success in implementing that approach. Is this something that libertarians should be looking at? Should we be looking at not so much finding people who really believe the things that we believe, but people who can be manipulated, for lack of a better term, to do what we want them to do?
I don't think that's what we want to see as a movement, as a candidate, but I think it's how we message, like we kind of full circle here talked about Kaepernick. It's how you message and communicate. And if you can hit that libertarian button to say, wow, that sounds great, and who would disagree with those kind of things? Like, I think like Ron Paul did, right? Like,
right,
hit these buttons, and a lot of people ate it up, myself included,
yeah,
right? I think like all of us, that those sound great, but we don't need a highly automatic, you know, polished robot to deliver that message. It's mm-hmm. just getting the right message in front of the right people. I think we'll talk about in our podcast. I don't think liberty is popular when you get down to it, get down to the details of it. I think superficially it's very popular. So we just need to hit those superficial buttons at first and get some of that. But as you get deeper into it,
speaking to, for example, though, foreign policy interventionism, there is an opportunity for, you know, popular influence on that issue. And I just point to the Senate race, the pending Senate race in Missouri. Austin Peterson, who you're probably familiar with, the was it the Libertarian Mind? He he ran forever as a libertarian activist, actually ran as for libertarian candidate for president, and is now actually mounting a highly credible campaign for the Republican Senate nomination against Claire McCaskill in Missouri. And that's, I mean, that's the kind of person who in the Senate in particular would be very influential in a beneficial way, and also has the support of the Trump coalition, from what I can tell, so far in Missouri. So yeah, I mean, I don't think that Trump is necessarily leech to any particular position. Whoever can help him out the most in, at any given time, I think, is going to be, you know, and you see that with Rand Paul. He just said he endorsed Rand Paul's healthcare bill, which is a great thing because, you know, he found out that other people couldn't help him with other things. And so, you know, if those are the people who can bend his ear, then hopefully it has a positive influence.
Brendan Peterson and Carl Eggers from the podcast Haughty by Nature. You can find it on iTunes. We'll continue when we return. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. I want to get into this new tax plan that President Donald Trump announced today, but we're going to take a call or two here before we get to that. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. In studio with us tonight, Carl Eggers, Brendan Peterson. They are from the Haughty by Nature podcast, which you can find on iTunes. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going tonight, Walter?
Fantastic, as always. What's on your mind?
I was wondering if Donald Trump was to come to Minnesota to help with the Senate race here and the governor's race here, do you think it would help out or do you think it would hurt?
It's hard to say. I mean, you could make the case that it would help because of the electoral shift which took place in terms of, you know, who turned out from where statewide in the last election. That said, this has never been a particularly Trump friendly state. He came in third here in the caucuses last year. And, there was quite a bit of resistance that I know firsthand about because I was one of the primary people organizing it and leading the way on it to him being the nominee here. So just in terms of where the Republican Party is, I'm not sure if we would be even interested in that, if the candidates would even be interested in that, or if it could be beneficial. Because the thing about that is that you're opening a Pandora's box. You have no idea what he's going to say. You have no idea how people are going to respond. It's not a narrative you can control. And one thing that candidates who are running for office like to be able to do is control their narrative. So I'm not sure it would be the best idea in
the
world.
And never Trump makes sense to me, but never Neuberger. That doesn't quite have the same same ring to it. I don't know if that would fly.
Do you have something against Neuberger?
I think he would be the one to Trump.
Right.
If Trump were to come, yeah, he would be the one to tag along. And I don't, never Neuberger doesn't roll up the tongue there.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't thought about whether or not Jim would be interested in connecting himself to Trump. But I suppose, you know, you see with, who is it, Keith Downey is really trying hard to appropriate the Trump messaging and
is
branding.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Like, even down to, like, his logo and his... I think the slogan for his campaign is something to the effect of make Minnesota work for everyone, which is a thinly veiled take on...
Okay.
Yeah.
Work
again.
Work great for everyone.
Yeah, right. So, and you on Twitter, he's become really combative, which if you've spent any amount of time in a conversation with Keith Downey, he's the furthest thing from Donald Trump in terms of persona and demeanor and decor.
Furthest thing from personality in general.
From personality,
right. From any personality whatsoever.
So for him to try to emulate that, it's borderline comical. But, you know, obviously there are people who see the way the winds are blowing and they want to try to adopt that for their own ends. I don't know if Neuberger is one of those, but it would be interesting to see him try. Let's go to Kevin in Lakeville. Welcome to the program.
Hi, gentlemen. Pleasure to talk with you tonight. I just wanted to relay a little different perspective, especially on that race down in Alabama. Now, I don't think the voters were voting against Trump's wishes down there. Strange was the attorney general of the state, and the governor was being investigated for some kind of lewd activities or something like that. I don't remember all what it was, but
So you think local politics beat out national politics in that situation?
Yeah, they dropped the investigation. Strange was the attorney general. He dropped the investigation on the governor and was then appointed to be a senator. And the people of Alabama were rejecting Strange for that reason.
Interesting.
That's what I'd heard from a caller on another talk show earlier today.
Gotcha. Well, and appreciate
as
you.
As far as Kaepernick and standing up for the national anthem and things like that, I am a truck driver. I see it out here every day. I see that black people are discriminated against by law enforcement as far as being stopped, searched, things like that. But I think he picked the wrong thing to do. They forgot and didn't take the perspective that that flag that he was disrespecting was flying on the battlefield of the people that freed his ancestors.
Appreciate your points, Kevin. That's what it comes down to. Whether you agree with that perspective or not, to reiterate the point that I was making last hour when we were talking about this, it's a question of how people receive something. You know, when you touch a nerve, and, you know, I didn't address your criticism of the analogy, Carl, that I used on Monday regarding being disrespectful to your mother, being disrespectful to your father. It's not that government is our parent, right? But it's that there is a rational expectation that you respect your parents because of who they are and what they've provided for you and what they represent, regardless of whatever specific behaviors or specific complaints that you may have against them. In a similar sense, for different reasons, there is a rational expectation that you respect the United States of America and what it is that it is that the idea from which it was born, what the notion of which is you have this freedom that we were talking about earlier to stand or not stand. And it's something that is not to be taken for granted, not something that the vast majority of people, both on the globe today and historically, have had the ability to enjoy. So just based upon that fact alone, by disrespecting that in the perception of the public, you're overshooting your intention, which is to raise awareness about a very specific issue. Let's go to this tax plan that it was announced today. And I think the best place to look for it here is in the release that came out of townhall.com from Kitty Pavlich. The bullet points are tax relief for middle-class families, the simplicity of postcard tax filing for the vast majority of Americans, tax relief for businesses, especially small businesses. I've never understood what's special about small businesses. Like, is there a certain point past which if you've enjoyed enough success as a business, it's no longer moral?
It pulls well. I mean, let's just cut it back to that. I mean, do we really need to say more than that? It's good messaging.
Mom and pop, Main Street versus Wall Street.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. Ending incentives to ship jobs, capital, and tax revenue overseas. There's your Bannon-esque nationalism there. Broadening the tax base and providing greater fairness for all Americans. Now, all of this, of course, sounds great, right? Now, specifically, how are they going to do it? They're creating what they call a zero tax bracket, which, you know, when you look at the details of this thing, sounds awfully democratic to me. Under the framework, typical middle-class families will see less of their income subject to federal income taxes. The framework specifies the tax code and provides tax relief by roughly doubling the standard deduction to $24,000 for married couples filing jointly. To simplify the tax rules, the additional standard deduction and personal exemptions for the taxpayer and spouse are consolidated into this larger standard deduction. In combination, these changes simplify tax filing and effectively create a larger zero tax bracket. That's a fancy way of saying even more people are going to pay no taxes. And even more of your income is not going to be subject to tax.
I talked to my friend who is a CPA. He's pretty politically apathetic. So I trust his judgment on this. And he said, to simplify the tax rules, the additional standard deduction and personal exemptions for the taxpayer and spouse are consolidated into just one big, larger standard deduction. So there's fewer deductions, which could hurt the middle class who rely on those deductions in the end. So in 2016, he says a single person filing with no kids, personal plus standard exemption was $10,350. And he said, so I ran the numbers. Essentially, if you make over $20,000 a year just taking single filers, you actually pay more in taxes than you did before because you may not have as many deductions. And so it's pretty tax neutral, but like if you relied on deductions, especially for like medical bills, like stuff that you can't really control for and like not every person might have, you could kind of get the short end of the stick there. And then it's really advantageous to small business owners because he said that they're going to limit earnings from companies to 25% before you could be taxed at whatever your highest rate was. But now you get capped, which in my entire time of working, I have seen maybe a few individuals who make over $150,000 who are not involved in a business. So pretty much if you make over $150,000, your tax rate is only 25%.
We'll continue breaking this down and get our takes from Carl Eggers and Brandon Peterson when we return. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
24.
Hugh Hefner's dead, apparently. That just broke. It's an end of an era? I don't know. I have a sense that that era kind of petered out a long time ago.
Yeah, I think it's over.
Phrasing.
Yeah, wait, nice use of the word peter.
Yeah, I don't know that we're going to see a significant change in the culture as a result of this passing, but it's certainly noteworthy.
Who wants to put money that Trump tweets about it?
We need to do a search. It's happening right now. He's typing right now. It's only a matter of time before the Trump tweet regarding Hefner.
He'll probably just bash him because his wife was never in it or something.
Something along those lines. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. In studio with us tonight, we have Carl Eggers and Brandon Peterson. They have a podcast called Haughty by Nature, which you can check out on iTunes, and I recommend that you do. So we got into just a little bit of the details of this tax plan that Trump announced today, and I'm kind of curious to hear your guys' take. Not on the specifics of the plan, because I'm sure you probably haven't had the opportunity to examine it. But this notion it at least occurs to me of we're always for taxes being cut, right? Like reductions in taxation. Taxation is theft, you know, the famous libertarian motto at this point and social media meme. But are tax cuts unto themselves the single most important thing that we ought to be focusing on in terms of, and I'll just limit it, not even to the all of public policy, but just to fiscal policy. Is it really the taxation that's the issue?
Well, no. How's that for an answer?
I agree, but what are your thoughts on what is the problem and the extent of it?
Well, it's the spending, stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, we are now still spending, you know, what, a trillion plus every year, or every budget cycle, whatever it is, more than we're taking in revenue. So you can, you know, as we know, borrowing is just taxation of future generations. So we're kicking the can down the road, to use the cliched term, with tax cuts. And we're, you know, this tax plan, you know, candidly, politically irrelevant, you know, maybe even a political liability, just speaking purely in a political sense, rearranging the deck chairs a little bit. I'm just not interested. I'm already bored. I don't even want to talk about it.
That's exactly where I'm at. The only reason I ever talk about tax reform and this notion that the Republicans are pushing about how excited they are about cutting taxes is because it's happening in a vacuum, absent the actual concern, which is the spending.
Right, and it has to be both, right? We were talking about immigration. You have to have some reduction of the welfare state if you want to talk about immigration. But the same thing, like, why is it so complicated, too? Why do we, it's like the American Healthcare Act from Paul Ryan. Why do we have to make this weird thing that you have to have a PowerPoint slide to hopefully try to present what I'm messaging to you, that I want, the tax cuts are there because I want to put more money in your pocket. I don't want to have you file less forms to the IRS or smaller forms in a postcard size to the IRS. I just want you to have more money in your pocket. That's the goal, right? You would hope. But that doesn't seem to be the goal of this plan. It's rearranging the deck chairs as well. If you look at it from this angle, you kind of might save some money, maybe, hopefully. And we can say we did something, Paul Ryan. But did we really? No, we don't care. we don't care about actually cutting your taxes and actually putting money in average Joe's pocket.
From the Star Tribune, in the absence of details on the plan's cost, one back-of-the-envelope estimate by a Washington budget watchdog estimated the tax cuts at perhaps $5.8 trillion over the next 10 years. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget Analysis said Republicans had only identified about $3.6 trillion in offsetting revenues, meaning the cost to the federal deficit could be in the $2.2 trillion range. Now, that's just the deficit. So that we're talking about year over year over year over year. I mean, my God.
But that's assuming that the plan goes in action for the next 5 years, which it never does.
Sure.
Right. But it never has changed in between now and then. But yeah, it's a terrible plan.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like if you're already at a point like we hope to run a $2 trillion deficit this year with this plan, then you're already dead.
Well, and politically, who's clamoring at the bit to get this
Paul
to see
Ryan,
this tax cut? Yeah.
Mitch McConnell. I mean, it's those people, right, that want to say they did something.
Right. It's certainly not that Trump base, that Steve Bannon-esque base that we were talking about that just pushed more over the edge in Alabama, right? Like, they don't care about
No, this. I mean, nobody cares. I mean, let's just be honest. It's going to do absolutely nothing for them. And again, I would say plays into actually a negative narrative that's inevitably going to be used against them in the elections. In fact, Bannon has been widely reported as advocating a higher tax rate for people who make, you know, $5 million plus per year. So, you know, they've abandoned a lot of the populist issues, even, you know, the foreign policy intervention. And I'll just come right out now and say it. I voted for Donald Trump almost exclusively, almost exclusively because he actually was saying things that we haven't heard in a long time from a Republican president, especially when it came to foreign policy, you know, that we were going to pull back and not become policemen of the world. And we've heard that time and time again. And
right.
And to me, that's one of the basic expenditures,
sure.
One of the biggest things that affects our lives. And I said, you know what, if I can get that, which we've never gotten from any administration since,
ever.
What, Grover Cleveland, I don't know, I'll take it.
Sure.
And he's failed on that too. So he's failing in all these areas. Tax this quote unquote small business tax cuts, saving tax cuts for job creators. I mean, I'm so bored.
Yeah.
Everybody's bored. Nobody cares except for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Right.
And frankly, who cares about them either unless you're in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
Yeah. I mean, politically, it strikes me as affirming the worst caricatures of what Republicans are about.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, because you're basically, this is them doing the bidding of their donors, the Wall Street donors and the big corporate donors who want the tax cut. It doesn't actually affect any things that Republicans typically talk about on the campaign trail in terms of, you know, reducing the deficit, reducing the debt, putting us on a saner path to fiscal stability. Not to mention the moral argument which you evoked, Brandon, of what are we doing to our kids and our grandkids? You know, sending them our credit card bill for the quality of life that we want to enjoy.
Right.
Have fun paying for
it. So you could have an extra $82.34 every 6 months from the whatever tax cut this is supposedly. I don't even know.
We got a call from Bill in Maple Grove, wants to bring us back to the flag concern. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Yeah, Walter, I appreciate your discussion about showing respect for the country and so forth, the reference. But it seems to me that taxes are in a similar field, that paying your taxes is part of showing respect. If you respect it, you support it. But don't continually gripe about it.
Yeah, I'm not following your reasoning. Can you expound a little bit?
If you respect the government and what it stands for, then you support it with your money.
So why stop at the given tax rate then? Should we be sending contributions above and beyond the current tax rate? Should we set the tax rate to 50%, 70%, 80% to show even more respect for?
Pay your dues. Don't always gripe about it. Don't always try to go on the cheap. Admit that it's your responsibility and just pay up.
So I'm interested in exploring this because I'm not hearing any sort of parameter which would determine what taxes ought to be, like how much taxes you should pay and what those tax dollars should be spent on.
It's what Congress determines.
So just anything? Literally anything?
It's what you owe. That's how you show respect. You don't constantly gripe about it and hedge about it. It's just like a kid going to your parent asks you to go mow the lawn, and you're constantly griping about, oh, it's so hard, and oh, the gas isn't, full, and who knows what. It's uphill this way, and it's downhill that way. Just pay your dues.
All right. I appreciate it, Bill. I tried to mold that into some sort of conversation, but I feel as though I failed miserably.
Yeah, there's no there. I'm sorry.
Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. In studio, Carl Eggers, Brendan Peterson, Haughty by Nature. What's the website again, guys?
Haughtypodcast.com. You can find us at Haughty by Nature on Facebook and Twitter and iTunes, and we're out there.
We're
all around you.
Check it out, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Sean Hannity.
So I got a few off-the-cuff questions for one of our in-studio guests here, Brendan Peterson, who is formerly a state senator here in Minnesota, and in that sense has gone where few have gone before in terms of campaigning and securing victory and holding office. And I definitely want to spend some time picking your brain here in our final segment of the evening. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. So was it worth it? Let's start with that. Was it worth it, all the effort and the time and the pain that you had to go through in order to serve? And would you contemplate doing something like that again?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the first part of the question, yes, sure. I would say that it was worth it, however you quantify that. I mean, it was everything. The experience was everything. It was the good, bad, and the ugly. But I'm somebody who says, you know, you kind of are what you've lived and experienced. And certainly I am that. And there were so many things that I picked up along the way in life experiences. And let's face it. I mean, it is the amount of humanity that you're exposed to, you know, opinions. And for wonks like us, you know, for the three of us at the table, you know, there is an element of just the job, just the literal like lawmaking element of it, where you get to kind of dig into things. I mean, you get to go to work and just talk about ideas all day. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, so that part was great. And there were other parts that were really frustrating, like the fact that a lot of things don't get done for the right reasons, really for the sake of getting more power or reelection or, you know, what have you. But overall, it wasn't. No. I mean, the second part of the question is no. I have no plans to do it again. I mean, I'm 31. I wouldn't. I think it would be ridiculous to say. I guarantee you for the rest of my life, I'm going to do that.
Right, yeah.
But I don't have any plans to. And right now, I'm really enjoying life more than I have really ever as an adult. And my wife, Jessica, my three kids. I mean, we're just having a great time right now. And I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah, and that is the interesting aspect of your story. And I don't know all the details of what brought you to your campaign in the first place to become a state senator, but I have to imagine that somewhere along the line there was perhaps a value judgment in terms of, you know, am I sacrificing too much on the personal side in order to continue down this course? Because there's not a lot of people who, you know, you were young as a state senator. Historically, even in terms of the average, there's not a lot of people who pursue that path at that age. Are there reasons for that? Are there disadvantages to trying to do something that young?
There's a lot of disadvantages. I mean, just a life experience in general. You know, I certainly had a lot of living to do and things to figure out for myself. And I won't get into all those things here on the radio, but so some of those things I had to confront and frankly were one of the reasons I left in the first place. But other than that, yeah, I mean, there's a whole bunch. Like, for example, most people get into electoral politics at the twilight of their professional career. You know, right. You look at the median age, 55, 60. These people have created a nest egg, established some financial security, and are looking sort of as this is their passion project at the end of their life, if you will. Whereas I was in the prime income earning years where you're trying to carve your place out in the world. And so for young candidates, you know, it's either, you know, you continue to escalate that political ladder in order to make a living.
Right.
which isn't the right motivation, right? I mean, right. You're there in my Pollyannish view of the public policy realm. You're there because you have principles and because you value things and you think that what you believe is quite literally good for humanity and mm-hmm. good for the community in which you live. So looking at it as what's the next rung on the career ladder is not a healthy way to look at it. And that's one of the things young people have to consider unless they have some, you know, they have a trust fund or family money or things like that. So there are certainly some challenges to doing it at a younger age.
Yeah. And I guess that's really what I was kind of trying to drive at is the unfortunate reality that you have to have certain ducks in a row to even be able to contemplate doing something like running for office, even at the level of just the state legislature, because it does require some degree of sacrifice, you know, and being privy to both having been involved with campaigns and also being kind of tangentially privy to the machinations within campaigns is one of the things that candidates have to consider. How am I going to survive during this? Like, how am I going to mm-hmm. get money in yeah. order to live during this? And it's not something that you can just in the framers' idea of the farmer just leaves his farm for a little bit and goes and serves and then goes back. It's not that simple anymore, and maybe it should be.
Well, and that's one of the problems, right, with the way we run our government. I mean, it was never supposed to be something you had to make that choice, you know, with. It was something where we were going to be citizen civilian legislators. And we were going to be able to do this on the side and still go farm or work in a trade or as a professional. And government outgrew that. You know, the right. needs of the state outgrew that. And so you have now people who are wholly dedicated to state servitude because it's seen as a necessary, and that, you know, as necessary evil, if you will, or some people think is a necessary benefit. And that's where we're at now. And, I would say also, you know, looking back, it may not be fair for the next 24-year-old, but I'll look at them with a healthy degree of skepticism. I think there is a lot there that you don't realize you're walking into, and it requires a great degree of humility. And also just the character, you know, most jobs, almost every job in the world, you're accountable. And you don't have, you know, people will tell you what time it is and your boss will tell you what you need to do. The legislature, there is very little of that. And so it requires somebody who has a great degree of self-discipline and also humility to understand the things they don't know. I know we're running short on time, but I mean, that's some of the things that I observed and would have some tough questions for a young man or lady who came right. to my door and wanted to do it. And I would tell them, you know, and I'd be very real with them too. It's a challenge on a lot of levels.
Well, I only wish that all of our elected officials and candidates approached the issue with that level of humility. Carl Eggers, Brandon Peterson, Haughty by Nature, haughtypodcast.com. Check it out. Appreciate you guys coming in tonight and spending
your
time with me. Yeah, anytime. You guys are welcome. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. Vikings football tomorrow night. So we will see you on Friday, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 100.3 HD2, and worldwide on iHeartRadio. This is the Twin Cities News Talk Station, KTLK AM, Minneapolis.
Playboy's founder has died. I'm Rich Dennison, Fox News. Hugh Hefner has passed away of natural causes at the age of 91.
Hef worked in the subscription.